Oh, on this week's program, a conversation with Thomas Chimes. A veteran artist is the subject of a new retrospective at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Jason Pfeiffer looks at the growing popularity of children's theater and speaks with the creators and producers of several family-oriented productions in Philadelphia. And Susan Lewis takes a look at how several nonprofits have taken over commercial movie theaters and restored and reinvented them as neighborhood art film houses. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
When a 10-year-old Thomas Chimes first visited the Philadelphia Museum of Art in 1931, he and his young brothers were thrown out by the guards for making comments and giggling about some of the displays. Now, over 75 years later, Chimes will be the reason for many people to visit the museum to see a new exhibition celebrating his work and life so far. Thomas Chimes was born in Philadelphia in 1921. In 1939, he enrolled at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, but his studies were quickly interrupted by the outbreak of World War II. He served in the United States Army Air Force during the war years before returning to his studies in New York in 1946. Under the GI Bill, he studied philosophy at Columbia University and painting and sculpture at the Art Students League. In 1953, Thomas Chimes made a conscious decision to return to Philadelphia, much to the bewilderment of many of his friends and colleagues in New York. Inspired by the artists and writers whose names have become associated with Philadelphia, most notably Thomas Eakins and Edgar Allan Poe, Chimes began to formulate an intensely personal and highly original iconography that often drew upon childhood memories and dreams. The exhibition Adventures in Pataphysics, which opens on Tuesday, celebrates the life and work of Thomas Chimes, now considered one of the most important and influential Philadelphia artists of the 20th century. It features 100 paintings, drawings, and other works, many previously unseen. Thomas Chimes' career can be divided into four distinct stylistic phases, and the new retrospective charts all of these, from early landscapes and iconoclastic works through the finely crafted metal box constructions that often incorporate small symbolic drawings, paintings, or even hidden messages, to the luminous white paintings that Chimes has been producing since the early 1980s and the diminutive portraits he has been creating since 1999. At the heart of the exhibition is a series of 48 panel portraits painted between 1973 and 1978 of 19th and early 20th century literary and art historical figures, including Alfred Jarry, the godfather of pataphysics, a philosophy that's been a major influence on the life and work of Thomas Chimes. I met with Thomas Chimes at the Philadelphia Museum of Art earlier this week. For those of us who have trouble even understanding metaphysics, please explain what, in simple terms, is pataphysics.
Pataphysics is the science of imaginary solutions. It extends as far beyond metaphysics as metaphysics extends beyond physics. And that's exactly the place that humor enters in.
Can I suggest that before you were even introduced to the idea of pataphysics, that you were already a pataphysicist or a pataphysician in your own mind?
Absolutely. When I ran across it for the first time, I just responded, and responded intensely. And as an artist, I felt, now, how can I use this?
Statements by two other very well-known artists have also been, to an extent, governing principles of how you've lived your life.
Warhol said that in the future, everybody is going to be famous for 15 minutes. And directly opposite, symmetrically, is Duchamp's comment that in the future the artist will go underground.
Those two statements are two that you've almost lived by. You are underground when you're creating, and you raise your head above the trench every so often to take on this 15 minutes of fame. Every time there's a major exhibition of yours, you're quite happy to cooperate with them. So these are, again, two statements that obviously affected you very greatly.
Yes, indeed. Another way of putting it is a wave. a wave will crest and then subside back into the bulk of the sea. That's another way of thinking of it.
A lot of the time people, when they see great artistic achievement, they almost nonchalantly say, well, the person's a great artist. And it doesn't really cover it for me. When I look at the changes that you've made, I have two questions come to mind. One, did these changes come gradually, or was there an epiphany? And two, when you decided that this would be your next mode of expression, and I'm talking particularly about some of these metal boxes, which have an extraordinary level of craftsmanship, did you then just draw down and know how to do this? Was there a learning process? Did you have somebody show you how to do these crafts, or were you just simply capable of doing them because that was the way you needed to express yourself?
I lived my life, although absolutely committed to being an artist, in such a way that I had a lot of different experiences. And pataphysically speaking, that's what a pataphysician does. He participates in the world and all that goes on there, but he's the one that understands what that world's really about. And the notion of absurdity is right there. Now, a lot of the things that I've dealt with in my work, for example, the technical thing that you brought up with the metal boxes, I had one time been an aircraft mechanic, and I worked with all kinds of materials. I learned how to weld aluminum, which is difficult to weld compared to steel and so forth and so on. And I did things during that period before I was drafted into the Air Corps, where the techniques and the methods I used as an aircraft mechanic, I saw later manifested in the art scene in New York with the minimal art and all kinds of different modes of expression.
So can I ask you the chicken and egg question? Did you express yourself in that way because you had the artistic capacity to do it, or...
It's not because I could do it that I use these things that I experienced and learned. It is because once the idea and the emotions that connect with the idea demanded that kind of technique or response, and then I could recall it. There were many other techniques that I could have used, which I had experienced also. But it's when the idea seizes me and the enthusiasm responds and I get carried away, that's when I become conscious of what techniques I can use.
Tell me about your process. Is it a case of rising at an exact time every morning and going to the studio and having a set of almost rituals that you go through to get yourself to the place where it flows, or is it something much more esoteric?
The process, to me, is something like this. Since I know that the conscious mind is based, founded upon the unconscious mind, I know that as an intellectual idea. And the fact that I remember dreams very well, when I get up in the morning, I am not completely in the conscious state. I think everybody recognizes that. A kind of... grogginess lingers with you. But the interesting thing, you're bringing part of the unconscious with you. So what do? Getting out of bed, I walk right over to the thing I was working on the evening before, and I know immediately what the next step must be. Because obviously during the night, I process it. And I would look and say, oh, I've got to move that over, adjust that, and so forth and so on. And almost a feeling of correcting something. If I had to do it before I forgot or before it got away from me. And that works day by day. And so I work every day, every day. It's not something that I have to be in the mood for anymore. The need to respond to what the unconscious is doing during the night is at this stage, particularly, I'm going to be 86 in April, is vital. It's important that I deal with this because I'm dealing with something I'm not fully aware of what the meaning is.
Do you fear the end of your life?
No, I don't.
What's after this manifestation of your spirit or your soul?
I think we come from somewhere and we return to someplace. Everything comes out of the earth and everything is completed back in the earth. And that, if you're talking about God and religion, to me, is the thing that I would agree with. Last time I was asked, do you believe in God? I responded by asking saying the person giving me that question, you tell me what God is and I'll respond. There was no further discussion. No further discussion.
Over the course of this more than 50-year-long career, you've created hundreds, if not thousands, of works of art. When you look back at this retrospective as it hangs here or as it's installed here at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, do you recognize the man who made a lot of those works?
The best way to answer that is yes and no. And I'll give you an example of the no part. I was called by the one who owns one of the pieces in the show on the phone and said, there's a piece of yours at the auction house, and I'm going down to see about it. And so I said, when's the auction? He says, it's tomorrow morning, or very close by. I said, do you think if I went over there by the time the place closes, I'll be able to see? He said, yeah, we'll try it. So I went over and finally came up to it, and I looked at it, and I said, I have no memory, absolutely none, of having ever done this. And then the next thought is, maybe I didn't do it. But whoever did do it is a pretty good good artist, a good technician. I said, it's well done, but I don't recognize. If it's a fake, it was well done. But that sort of answers your question.
It was yours, I take it.
It was mine.
Thomas Chimes. A new retrospective of his work, Adventures in Pataphysics, opens at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on Tuesday and runs through May 6th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
For many people, going to the movies these days involves a trip to the mall, as so many neighborhood cinemas have closed. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at how nonprofits are reinventing and restoring these old movie houses as venues for art films and documentaries.
We're standing outside a movie theater, but not just any movie theater. We're in the suburbs, but nowhere near a mall or a multiplex. This is Main Street, USA, or actually, Lancaster Avenue in Bryn Mawr. But this theater, nestled among small shops and restaurants, feels like the kind of small-town cinema people used to visit for their weekly entertainment, where they'd run into their neighbors and see the latest flick on the big screen. The Bryn Mawr Theater's still serving that function, and more. Tonight is an open screen event where local filmmakers can show up with their short films and get them in front of the public. So let's go inside.
My name is Danny Corey. My film is called Someone Else's Shoes, and it's sort of a thriller, suspense, horror, but sort of in a funny way.
My name is Misha Zubrov, The title of the project that I'm submitting is Journey.
My name is Steve Bundrick. My film is a trailer for a feature film, Dodging Silver Bullets, which is Romeo and Juliet in a trailer park. This is the first time it's ever being seen by anyone other than family and friends.
The filmmakers check in with the woman charged with putting together tonight's program. Alice Bullitt, Bryn Mawr's programming and events coordinator, says the selection process is based not on content.
It's a first-come, first-served basis. You simply have to show up anytime after 8 o'clock to submit a film and get it put on a list.
The Bryn Mawr doesn't just serve as an outlet for local movie makers, however. It's typical of a growing number of independently owned movie houses, many of which are run by nonprofit organizations catering to an audience not served by the big chains.
My first motivation was to save a place where films could bring the community together, where people could watch good films.
Juliet Goodfriend is president of the Bryn Mawr Film Institute, which now runs the Bryn Mawr Movie Theater. Built in 1926 as the Spanish-themed Seville, it, like other cinemas of the time, was designed as a movie palace with a large auditorium and plush decor to help sweep the audiences into a different time and place. Beyond the classical facade, a vaulted skylit atrium led from the street to the theater. Over time, changes were made. By the 1950s, the atrium skylight and second-story arcade were concealed by a dropped tile ceiling. By the 80s, the auditorium had been divided in two and the marquee outside had twice been replaced. In recent years, the theater struggled to survive against competition from multiplexes and changing audience habits. When in 2001, the national chain that managed the theater went bankrupt, there was talk of turning it into a health club. In response, a community coalition formed the Bryn Mawr Film Institute. As it happened, the Bryn Mawr was not the only theater being saved in this fashion. John Toner gave up law to run Renew Theaters, a group that now operates the Bryn Mawr along with other independent art house cinemas in Ambler and in Doylestown, where, with the county theater, the idea of this kind of rescue first played out.
The county theater looked like it was going to close down in 1992. We got together with the owner and worked out an agreement. We decided to do it as a nonprofit and have membership and show art films and classic films.
The success of the county was so overwhelming, Toner says, that they looked for other theaters in similar straits. In 2001, they got involved with the Ambler Theater, and after that joined forces with Juliet Goodfriend to help save the Bryn Mawr. Of course, saving a failing business involves scaling significant financial hurdles, and in the case of these particular theaters, keeping movies on the screens was only part of the challenge.
The reason that these three theaters are nonprofit is that the costs to rehabilitate them, to bring them to even safe standards, is huge. No commercial operator could afford to do that on the back of box office alone.
The theaters sell memberships and also raise funds for the restoration, refurbishment, and updating of the structure, because the building must conjure its original glamour and meet the viewing demands of today's moviegoers. As viewing habits have changed, so has technology, making a potential filmmaker out of anyone armed with a story and a digital camcorder. Yet although some small films are digital and show up on DVDs, the larger features still arrive in 35mm reels. John Toner says there are three factors working against the move to digital: fears of piracy, which is easier with digital technology, the politics of distribution, and even today, the quality of the film. 35mm is still considered better for the big screen, says Toner.
When digital goes off track, it's like your computer. Everything's haywire. You want to hit it with a hammer. Whereas 35mm film is sort of like a Chevy Impala circa 1966 with a V8 engine. If you keep it in good shape, it's just going to go on forever.
With all these choices, programming at these theaters is more an art than a science, even to those who do it.
I've been booking the main films and helping book the specialized programming that we do at the theaters now for over 10 years. And the more I do it, the less certain I am as to what I'm doing.
Toner says that what makes any particular film art is not an easy question to answer. Once there was a clear line between Hollywood films and those independently made and financed. These, he says, were principally foreign films, like those made by Truffaut or Bergman.
Sometime in the 90s, those categories started to blur, and it had to do with Miramax doing a really good job distributing quote-unquote art films like The Piano, and the mainstream exhibitors seeing that there was money to be made in specialized or art films.
And so the theaters show a mix of independent, documentary, art, and repertory films. Some movies are those playing down the highway at the mall. Others are small films that wouldn't otherwise get a showing, at least not at a mainstream cinema. Barbara Fried is a case in point. A professor of French and linguistics at Carnegie Mellon, Fried, along with a camera person and a film editor, made her first film, A Model for Matisse, after translating a book by a Dominican nun. The book told of the nun's friendship with the great French post-impressionist Henri Matisse and the creation of the Chapel of the Rosary in the village of Vence.
Mostly I wanted to tell the story of this little-known and amazing friendship, and I also wanted to have a visual archive of the creation of the chapel.
Theaters like Bryn Mawr, Ambler, and the County make space for films like this, and filmmakers are happy for the opportunity.
I'm usually there for question and answer, and I'm always amazed at the kinds of questions people ask.
A connection between filmmaker and audience is just one of the many made by these reinvented movie houses. People meet their neighbors, and friendships flourish. What's more, the success of each cinema has helped rejuvenate its surrounding area, says Toner.
The community response and the effect on the businesses in the downtown area was totally unanticipated and totally overwhelming, and it was so gratifying to have that type of impact.
And so these new, old-style cinemas press on, serving a core audience of baby boomers and older. In a fast-changing world where films can be watched alone on your TV, computer screen, or even your iPod, the challenge will be the next generation. Toner and Goodfriend are optimistic. People who love movies, they say, love movies. And DVDs will never replace the experience of sitting with friends and strangers, watching good films in the dark.
WRTI, Susan Lewis. Take a quick scan of theater productions offered this season in the Philadelphia area, and you'll see that a handful of the largest regional theaters have been staging shows with children in mind. Anne of Green Gables was just at the People's Light and Theater. The Philadelphia Theater Company produced its first family show, The Frog Bride, over the holidays. And the BFG, or Big Friendly Giant, recently finished a run at the Arden Theater, with Ferdinand the Bull coming up there soon. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer looks into this concentration of shows designed to appeal to younger audiences and finds an emerging trend.
Theater for children and the family is certainly not a new idea. It's long been a strong tradition in Europe, for example, especially around the holidays. But historically, it hasn't been taken as seriously among professional theater companies in the United States. There have been some exceptions. Seattle Children's Theater, one of the country's largest resident theaters for young audiences, was started in 1975. And the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis, founded in 1965, is widely considered the gold standard of North American theater for young audiences. In 2002, the Minneapolis company premiered the children's theater smash hit A Year with Frog and Toad, which eventually made its way to Broadway.
Hello, Toad.
Hello, Frog.
What are you doing in my dream?
Well, funny, I was about to ask you the same thing.
Oh, well, it certainly is nice to see you.
I feel the same way. How has your winter been?
Well, I'm hibernating, so there isn't much to report.
It's about the same for me. This is a very nice dream, though.
Yes, it is.
In 2004, the Arden Theater Company staged A Year with Frog and Toad, and the production received critical acclaim, picking up two Barrymore Awards. Arden artistic director Terry Nolan points out that this sort of recognition for a children's show in Philadelphia reflects a shift in attitudes about the theater genre, in contrast to nearly 10 years ago when, according to Nolan, local newspapers rarely reviewed or covered such productions. Although that's changed, he says similar aversions still remain among many people.
A lot of times we have this idea that children's theater is second rate or it's second tier, it's something that you have the interns do, and there are a lot of theaters that do that. And so it has the same sort of negative connotation at times as bad productions of A Christmas Carol, as something people do to exploit the opportunity, not for artistic reasons.
When the Arden started their children's theater series 9 years ago, they were determined to use the same talent, time, money, and energy as they would for any regular adult-oriented production. Maureen Sweeney, director of education for the Philadelphia Theater Company, says this sort of dedication to theater for young audiences is becoming much more common in the U.S., particularly within the past 5 years.
The growth that we're seeing in the genre, I feel like, is a response to families wanting to do something together. It's not just something that schools can go to for a class trip. It's not just kids' theater shows that, you know, are books that they're reading in school, but families are really seeking out entertainment. Whereas children's literature and TV and movies, all of that kept right up to pace with the quality level that parents were demanding for their kids. And theater really hadn't done that for a while. It had been doing it in pockets in, you know, Minneapolis and, you know, some of the bigger children's theater-based companies, but not as a whole. And now we are seeing that happening.
Productions designed with young audiences in mind involve various approaches and take different forms. This is reflected in the mere wording that's used to market these type of shows. One company might call their production family theater to avoid the potential baggage that can be associated with children's theater. The phrase children's theater can imply that the production values are subpar, that it's performed by children, or it only appeals to children. While recognizing these sort of pitfalls, Some companies, like the Arden Theater, still prefer the Children's Theater label. Artistic director Terry Nolan.
One of the reasons we call it Arden Children's Theater is it's first and foremost for kids. So that's our audience. I like that there are some adults who come see our children's theater productions without kids. I think that's great. But it is for kids.
Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Theater Company billed their recent holiday show, The Frog Bride, as a production for the whole family. In the view of David Gonzalez, the creator and performer of the show based on a Russian fairy tale, there's a distinction between theater for children and family theater.
Family theater that I'm interested in is, you might want to call, intergenerational theater as well. That is, an elder can see their life in these myths and stories and presentations, the art values, as well as a youngster, as well as a middle-aged man or woman.
Semantic nuances aside, family theater and children's theater are, at the least, both very intentional about including and appealing to young audiences. This affects how the shows are conceived, written, and produced in many ways. For example, lewd and complex political material is usually not appropriate for young viewers. But Whit McLaughlin, who directed the BFG and other children's theater productions at the Arden Theater, explains that for him, the difference between directing a show for young people and a show strictly for adults is not drastic.
You want to avoid the sort of simplified, simplistic, quote-unquote, children's theater feeling, which is important themes dealt with simplistically. Now, children don't want a certain complexity, but they want humanness in there. So that enriches what's at the heart of these plays. I think it takes an adult sensibility to be able to kind of understand that for children.
McLaughlin adds that when a children's theater show has high production values and provides a deeply imaginative experience, it should on some level speak to the childlike nature in everyone, not just one age bracket. In light of the success of Disney Broadway shows like Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, Tarzan, and Mary Poppins, it's evident that there's money to be made in the children's and family theater genre, and that prospect has likely helped fuel the recent surge in theater for young audiences. And it seems the genre will continue to grow in the coming years. But people like the Arden Theater's Terry Nolan caution that there is a danger in the motivations of some companies getting involved in the field, hoping to discover a cash cow.
If it becomes a financially driven concern, if theaters start doing it in order to generate additional income, then I don't think that bodes well for the development of the art. If theaters do it for the same reasons they do their best theatrical work, because it's their passion, because they really care, because they really believe that this says something of value, if they're fueled by those motivations, then the field can just explode and really be enriched.
And as conventional wisdom goes, exposing young audiences to high-quality, solidly crafted theater now will go a long way in cultivating tomorrow's audiences.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Elizabeth Flynn and Norman Keyes. Gravely Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.